Those were perhaps the worst moments they had been through yet. The horrible sounds of Smaug's anger were echoing in the stony hollows far above. At any moment he might come blazing down or fly whirling round and find them there, near the perilous cliff's edge, hauling madly on the ropes. Up came Bofa, and still all was safe. Up came Bomber, puffing and blowing while the ropes creaked, and still all was safe. Up came some tools and bundles of stores, and then danger was upon them. A whirring noise was heard. A red light touched the points of standing rocks. The dragon came.
This ends Disc 7.
Every vessel in the town was filled with water. Every warrior was armed. Every arrow and dart was ready. And the bridge to the land was thrown down and destroyed, before the roar of Smaug's terrible approach grew loud, and the lake rippled red as fire beneath the awful beating of his wings. Amid shrieks and wailing and the shouts of men, he came over them, swept towards the bridges, and was foiled. The bridge was gone, and his enemies were on an island in deep water, too deep and dark and cool for his liking. If he plunged into it, a vapour and a steam would arise enough to cover all the land with a mist for days. But the lake was mightier than he. It would quench him before he could pass through. Roaring, he swept back over the town. A hail of dark arrows leapt up and snapped and rattled on his scales and jewels, and their shafts fell back, kindled by his breath burning and hissing into the lake. No fireworks you ever imagined equaled the sights that night. At the twanging of the bows and the shrilling of the trumpets, the dragon's wrath blazed to its height, till he was blind and mad with it. No one had dared to give battle to him for many an age, nor would they have dared now, if it had not been for the grim-voiced man, Bard was his name, who ran to and fro cheering on the archers, and urging the master to order them to fight to the last arrow. Fire leapt from the dragon's jaws. He circled for a while, high in the air above them, lighting all the lake. The trees by the shores shone like copper and like blood, with leaping shadows of dense black at their feet. Then down he swooped straight through the arrow storm, reckless in his rage, taking no heed to turn his scaly sides towards his foes, seeking only to set their town ablaze. Fire leapt from thatched roofs and wooden beam ends as he hurtled down and past and round again, though all had been drenched with water before he came. Once more water was flung by 100 hands wherever a spark appeared. Back swirled the dragon. A sweep of his tail, and the roof of the great house crumbled and smashed down. Flames unquenchable sprang high into the night. Another swoop, and another house, and then another sprang afire and fell, and still no arrow hindered Smaug, or hurt him more than a fly from the marshes.
This ends Disc 8. The Hobbit, Disc 9.
Already men were jumping into the water on every side. Women and children were being huddled into laden boats in the market pool. Weapons were flung down. There was mourning and weeping. Where but a little time ago the old songs of mirth to come had been sung about the dwarves, now men cursed their names. The master himself was turning to his great gilded boat, hoping to row away in the confusion and save himself. Soon all the town would be deserted and burned down to the surface of the lake. That was the dragon's hope. They could all get into boats for all he cared. There he could have fine sport hunting them, or they could stop till they starved. Let them try to get to land, and he would be ready. Soon he would set all the shoreland woods ablaze and wither every field and pasture. Just now he was enjoying the sport of town-baiting more than he had enjoyed anything for years. But there was still a company of archers that held their ground among the burning houses. Their captain was Bard, grim-voiced and grim-faced, whose friends had accused him of prophesying floods and poisoned fish, though they knew his worth and courage. He was a descendant in long line of Gideon, Lord of Dale, whose wife and child had escaped down the running river from the ruin long ago. Now he shot with a great yew-bow, till all his arrows but one were spent. The flames were near him, his companions were leaving him. He bent his bow for the last time. Suddenly out of the dark something fluttered to his shoulder. He started, but it was only an old thrush. Unafraid, it perched by his ear, and it brought him news. Marvelling, he found he could understand its tongue, for he was of the race of Dale.
"Wait, wait," it said to him. "The moon is rising. Look for the hollow of the left breast as he flies and turns above you."
And while Bard paused in wonder, it told him of tidings up in the mountain and of all that it had heard. Then Bard drew his bowstring to his ear. The dragon was circling back, flying low, and as he came the moon rose above the eastern shore and silvered his great wings.
"Arrow," said the bowman, "Black Arrow, I have saved you to the last. You have never failed me, and always I have recovered you. I had you from my father, and he from of old. If ever you came from the forges of the true king under the mountain, go now and speed well." The dragon swooped once more, lower than ever, and as he turned and dived down, his belly glittered white with sparkling fires of gems in the moon, but not in one place. The great bow twanged. The black arrow sped straight from the string, straight for the hollow by the left breast where the foreleg was flung wide. In it smote and vanished barb, shaft, and feather, so fierce was its flight. With a shriek that deafened men, felled trees and split stone, Smaug shot spouting into the air, turned over and crashed down from on high in ruin. Full on the town he fell. His last throws splintered it to sparks and gleeds. The lake roared in. A vast steam leapt up, white in the sudden dark under the moon. There was a hiss, a gushing whirl, and then silence. And that was the end of Smaug and Esgaroth, but not of Bard. The waxing moon rose higher and higher, and the wind grew loud and cold. It twisted the white fog into bending pillars and hurrying clouds, and drove it off to the west to scatter in tattered shreds over the marshes before Mirkwood. Then the many boats could be seen, dotted dark on the surface of the lake, and down the wind came the voices of the people of Esgaroth, lamenting their lost town and goods and ruined houses. But they had really much to be thankful for, had they thought of it, though it could hardly be expected that they should just then. 3/4 of the people of the town had at least escaped alive. Their woods and fields and pastures and cattle and most of their boats remained undamaged. And the dragon was dead. What that meant, they had not yet realized. They gathered in mournful crowds upon the western shores, shivered in the cold wind, and their first complaints and anger were against the master, who had left the town so soon, while some were still willing to defend it. "He may have had a good head for business, especially his own business," some murmured, "but he's no good when anything serious happens." And they praised the courage of Bard and his last mighty shot. If only he had not been killed, they all said, we would have made him a king. Bard, the dragon shooter of the line of Geryon, alas that he is lost. And in the very midst of their talk, a tall figure stepped from the shadows. He was drenched with water. His black hair hung wet over his face and shoulders, and a fierce light was in his eyes.
Bard is not lost, he cried. He dived from Esgaroth when the enemy was slain. I am Bard of the line of Geryon. I am the slayer of the dragon.
King Bard! King Bard! They shouted, but the master ground his chattering teeth.
Geryon was lord of Dale, not king of Esgaroth, he said. In the lake town, we've always elected masters from among the old and wise, and have not endured the rule of mere fighting men. Let King Bard go back to his own kingdom. Dale is now freed by his valour, and nothing hinders his return. And any that wish can go with him, if they prefer the cold shores under the shadow of the mountain to the green shores of the lake. The wise will stay here and hope to rebuild our town, and enjoy again in time its peace and riches.
We will have King Bard, the people near at hand shouted in reply. We've had enough of the old men and the money counters. And people further off took up the cry, up the Bowmen, and down with Moneybags, till the clamour echoed along the shore.
I am the last man to undervalue Bard the Bowman, said the master warily, for Bard now stood close beside him. He has tonight earned an eminent place in the roll of the benefactors of our town, and is worthy of many imperishable songs. But why, oh, people! And here the master rose to his feet and spoke very loud and clear.
Why do I get all your blame? For what fault am I to be deposed? Who aroused the dragon from his slumber, I might ask? Who obtained of us rich gifts and ample help, and led us to believe that old songs could come true? Who played on our soft hearts and our pleasant fancies? What sort of gold have they sent down the river to reward us? Dragon, fire, and ruin? From whom should we claim the recompense of our damage, and aid for our widows and orphans?
As you see, the master had not got his position for nothing. The result of his words was that for the moment the people quite forgot their idea of a new king, and turned their angry thoughts towards Thorin and his company. Wild and bitter words were shouted from many sides, and some of those who had before sung the old songs loudest were now heard as loudly crying that the dwarves had stirred the dragon up against them deliberately.
Fools, said Bard, why waste words and wrath on those unhappy creatures? Doubtless they perished first in fire before Smaug came to us.
Then, even as he was speaking, the thought came into his heart of the fabled treasure of the mountain, lying without guard or owner, and he fell suddenly silent. He thought of the master's words, and of Dale rebuilt, and filled with golden bells, if he could but find the men. At length he spoke again.
This is no time for angry words, master, or for considering weighty plans of change. There's work to do. I serve you still, though after a while I may think again of your words and go north with any that will follow me.
Then he strode off to help in the ordering of the camps, and in the care of the sick and the wounded. But the master scowled at his back as he went, and remained sitting on the ground. He thought much, but said little, unless it was to call loudly for men to bring him fire and food. Now everywhere Bard went, he found talk running like fire among the people concerning the vast treasure that was now unguarded. Men spoke of the recompense for all their harm that they would soon get from it, and wealth over and to spare with which to buy rich things from the south, and it cheered them greatly in their plight. That was as well, for the night was bitter and miserable. Shelters could be contrived for few. The master had one, and there was little food. Even the master went short. Many took ill of wet and cold and sorrow that night, and afterwards died, who had escaped uninjured from the ruin of the town. And in the days that followed, there was much sickness and great hunger. Meanwhile, Bard took the lead, and ordered things as he wished, though always in the master's name, and he had a hard task to govern the people and direct the preparations for their protection and housing. Probably most of them would have perished in the winter that now hurried after autumn, if help had not been to hand. But help came swiftly, for Bard at once had speedy messengers sent up the river to the forest to ask the aid of the King of the Elves of the Wood, and these messengers had found a host already on the move, although it was then only the third day after the fall of Smaug. The elven king had received news from his own messengers and from the birds that loved his folk, and already knew much of what had happened. Very great indeed was the commotion among all things with wings that dwelt on the borders of the desolation of the dragon. The air was filled with circling flocks, and their swift-flying messengers flew here and there across the sky. Above the borders of the forest there was whispering, crying, and piping. Far over Mirkwood tidings spread. Smaug is dead! Leaves rustled and startled ears were lifted. Even before the Elven King rode forth, the news had passed west, right to the pine woods of the Misty Mountains. Bjorn had heard it in his wooden house, and the goblins were at council in their caves.
"That will be the last we shall hear of Thorin Oakenshield, I fear," said the king. "He would have done better to have remained my guest. It is an ill wind, all the same," he added, "that blows no one any good." For he, too, had not forgotten the legend of the wealth of Thror. So it was that Bard's messengers found him now marching with many spearmen and bowmen, and crows were gathered thick above him, for they thought that war was awakening again, such as had not been in those parts for a long age. But the king, when he received the prayers of Bard, had pity, for he was the lord of a good and kindly people. So turning his march, which had at first been direct toward the mountain, he hastened now down the river to the long lake. He had not boats or rafts enough for his host, and they were forced to go the slower way by foot. But great store of goods he sent ahead by water. Still, elves are light-footed, and though they were not in these days much used to the marches and the treacherous lands between the forest and the lake, their going was swift. Only 5 days after the death of the dragon, they came upon the shores and looked on the ruins of the town. Their welcome was good, as may be expected, and the men and their master were ready to make any bargain for the future in return for the Elven King's aid. Their plans were soon made. With the women and the children, the old and the unfit, the master remained behind, and with him were some men of crafts and many skilled elves, and they busied themselves felling trees and collecting the timber sent down from the forest. Then they set about raising many huts by the shore against the oncoming winter. And also, under the master's direction, they began the planning of a new town, designed more fair and large even than before, but not in the same place. They had moved northward higher up the shore, for ever after they had a dread of the water where the dragon lay. He would never again return to his golden bed, but was stretched cold as stone, twisted upon the floor of the shallows. There, for ages, his huge bones could be seen in calm weather amid the ruined piles of the old town. But few dared to cross the cursed spot, and none dared to dive into the shivering water or recover the precious stones that fell from his rotting carcass. But all the men of arms, who were still able, and the most of the Elven King's array, got ready to march north to the mountain. It was thus that in 11 days from the ruin of the town
the head of their host passed the rock gates at the end of the lake and came into the desolate lands.
Chapter 15. The Gathering of the Clouds. Now we will return to Bilbo and the dwarves. All night one of them had watched, but when morning came, they had not heard or seen any sign of danger. But ever more thickly the birds were gathering. Their companies came flying from the south, and the crows that still lived about the mountain were wheeling and crying unceasingly above.
"Something strange is happening," said Thorin. "The time has gone for the autumn wanderings, and these are birds that dwell always in the land. There are starlings and flocks of finches, and far off there are many carrion birds, as if a battle were afoot."
Suddenly Bilbo pointed.
"There is that old thrush again," he cried. "He seems to have escaped when Smaug smashed the mountainside, but I don't suppose the snails have."
Sure enough, the old thrush was there, and as Bilbo pointed, he flew towards them and perched on a stone nearby. Then he fluttered his wings and sang. Then he cocked his head on one side as if to listen, and again he sang, and again he listened.
"I believe he's trying to tell us something," said Balin. "But I can't follow the speech of such birds. It's very quick and difficult. Can you make it out, Baggins?"
"Not very well," said Bilbo. As a matter of fact, he could make nothing of it at all. "But the old fellow seems very excited."
"I only wish he was a raven," said Balin.
"I thought you didn't like them. You seemed very shy of them when we came this way before."
"Those were crows, and nasty, suspicious-looking creatures at that, and rude as well. You must have heard the ugly names they were calling after us. But the ravens are different. There used to be great friendship between them and the people of Thror, and they often brought us secret news, and were rewarded with such bright things as they coveted to hide in their dwellings. They live many a year, and their memories are long, and they hand on their wisdom to their children. I knew many among the ravens of the rocks when I was a dwarf lad. This very height was once named Ravenhill, because there was a wise and famous pair, old Kark and his wife, that lived here above the guard chamber. But I don't suppose that any of that ancient breed linger here now."
No sooner had he finished speaking than the old thrush gave a loud call and immediately flew away.
"We may not understand him, but that old bird understands us, I'm sure," said Balin. "Keep watch now and see what happens."
Before long there was a fluttering of wings, and back came the thrush. And with him came a most decrepit old bird. He was getting blind, he could hardly fly, and the top of his head was bald. He was an aged raven of great size. He alighted stiffly on the ground before them, slowly flapped his wings, and bobbed towards Thorin.
"Oh, Thorin, son of Thrain, and Balin, son of Fundin," he croaked,
and Bilbo could understand what he said, for he used ordinary language and not bird speech.
"I am Roek, son of Kark. Kark is dead, but he was well known to you once. It is 153 since I came out of the egg, but I do not forget what my father told me. Now I am the chief of the great ravens of the mountain. We are few, but we remember still the king that was of old. Most of my people are abroad, for there are great tidings in the south. Some are tidings of joy to you, and some you will not think so good.
Behold, the birds are gathering back again to the mountain and to dale from south and east and west, for word has gone out that Smaug is dead.
Dead? Dead? Shouted the dwarves. Dead? Then we have been in needless fear, and the treasure is ours!
They all sprang up and began to caper about for joy.
Yes, dead, said Roac. The thrush, may his feathers never fall, saw him die, and we may trust his words. He saw him fall in battle with the men of Esgaroth the third night back from now at the rising of the moon.
It was some time before Thorin could bring the dwarves to be silent and listen to the raven's news. At length, when he had told all the tale of the battle, he went on.
So much for joy, Thorin Oakenshield. You may go back to your halls in safety. All the treasure is yours, for the moment. But many are gathering hither beside the birds. The news of the death of the guardian has already gone far and wide, and the legend of the wealth of Thror has not lost in the telling during many years. Many are eager for a share of the spoil. Already a host of the elves is on the way, and carrion birds are with them, hoping for battle and slaughter. By the lake, men murmur that their sorrows are due to the dwarves, for they are homeless, and many have died, and Smaug has destroyed their town. They, too, think to find amends from your treasure, whether you are alive or dead. Your own wisdom must decide your course, but 13 is small remnant of the great folk of Durin that once dwelt here, and now are scattered far. If you will listen to my counsel, you will not trust the master of the lakemen, but rather him that shot the dragon with his bow. Bard is he, of the race of Tail, of the line of Gideon. He is a grim man, but true. We would see peace once more among dwarves and men and elves after the long desolation, but it may cost you dear in gold. I have spoken.
Then Thorin burst forth in anger.
Our thanks, Roac Kark's son. You and your people shall not be forgotten, but none of our gold shall thieves take or the violent carry off while we are alive. If you would earn our thanks still more, bring us news of any that draw near. Also I would beg of you, if any of you are still young and strong of wing, that you would send messengers to our kin in the mountains of the north, both west from here and east, and tell them of our plight. But go specially to my cousin Dain in the Iron Hills, for he has many people well armed, and dwells nearest to this place. Bid him hasten.
I will not say if this counsel be good or bad, croaked Roac. But I will do what can be done.
Then off he slowly flew.
Back now to the mountain, cried Thorin. We have little time to lose.
And little food to use, cried Bilbo, always practical on such points. In any case, he felt that the adventure was, properly speaking, over with the death of the dragon, in which he was much mistaken. And he would have given most of his share of the profits for the peaceful winding up of these affairs.
Back to the mountain,
cried the dwarves, as if they had not heard him. So back he had to go with them. As you've heard some of the events already, you will see that the dwarves still had some days before them. They explored the caverns once more, and found, as they expected, that only the front gate remained open. All the other gates, except, of course, the small secret door, had long ago been broken and blocked by Smaug, and no sign of them remained. So now they began to labour hard in fortifying the main entrance, and in remaking the road that led from it. Tools were to be found in plenty that the miners and quarriers and builders of old had used, and at such work the dwarves were still very skilled. As they worked, the ravens brought them constant tidings. In this way, they learned that the elven king had turned aside to the lake, and they still had a breathing space. Better still, they heard that three of their ponies had escaped and were wandering wild, far down the banks of the running river, not far from where the rest of their stores had been left. So while the others went on with their work, Feely and Keely were sent, guided by a raven, to find the ponies and bring back all they could. They were 4 days gone, and by that time they knew that the joined armies of the lake men and the elves were hurrying towards the mountain. But now their hopes were higher, for they had food for some weeks with care, chiefly Cram, of course, and they were very tired of it. But Cram is much better than nothing, and already the gate was blocked with a wall of squared stones laid dry, but very thick and high across the opening. There were holes in the wall through which they could see or shoot, but no entrance. They climbed in or out with ladders and hauled stuff up with ropes. For the issuing of the stream, they had contrived a small low arch under the new wall, but near the entrance they had so altered the narrow bed that a wide pool stretched from the mountain wall to the head of the fall over which the stream went towards Dale. Approach to the gate was now only possible, without swimming, along a narrow ledge of the cliff, to the right as one looked outwards from the wall. The ponies they had brought only to the head of the steps above the old bridge, and unloading them there, had bidden them return to their masters and sent them back riderless to the south. There came a night when suddenly there were many lights, as of fires and torches, away south in Dale before them.
"They have come," called Balin, "and their camp is very great. They must have come into the valley under the cover of dusk along both banks of the river."
That night the dwarves slept little. The morning was still pale when they saw a company approaching. From behind their wall they watched them come up to the valley's head and climb slowly up. Before long they could see that both men of the lake, armed as if for war, and elvish bowmen were among them. At length the foremost of these climbed the tumbled rocks and appeared at the top of the falls, and very great was their surprise to see the pool before them and the gate blocked with a wall of new-hewn stone. As they stood pointing and speaking to one another, Thorin hailed them.
"Who are you?" he called in a very loud voice. "That come as if in war to the gates of Thorin, son of Thrain, king under the mountain. And what do you desire?"
But they answered nothing. Some turned swiftly back, and the others, after gazing for a while at the gate and its defences, soon followed them. That day the camp was moved, and was brought right between the arms of the mountain. The rocks echoed then with voices and with song, as they had not done for many a day. There was the sound, too, of elven harps and of sweet music. And as it echoed up towards them, it seemed that the chill of the air was warmed, and they caught faintly the fragrance of woodland flowers blossoming in spring. Then Bilbo longed to escape from the dark fortress and to go down and join in the mirth and feasting by the fires. Some of the young dwarves were moved in their hearts too, and they muttered that they wished things had fallen out otherwise, and that they might welcome such folk as friends. But Thorin scowled. Then the dwarves themselves brought forth harps and instruments regained from the hoard, and made music to soften his mood. But their song was not as elvish song, and was much like the song they had sung long before in Bilbo's little hobbit hole.
Under the mountain dark and tall, the king has come unto his hall. His foe is dead, the worm of dread, and ever so his foe shall fall. The sword is sharp, the spear is long, the arrow swift, the gate is strong, the heart is bold that looks on gold, the dwarves no more shall suffer wrong. The dwarves of yore made mighty spells, while hammers fell like ringing bells, in places deep where dark things sleep, in hollow halls beneath the fells. On silver necklaces they strung the light of stars, on crowns they hung the dragon far, from twisted wire the melody of harps they rung. The mountain throne once more is freed, O wandering folk, the summons heed. Come haste, across the waste, the king of friend and kin has need. Now call we over mountains cold, come back unto the caverns old. Here at the gates the king awaits, his hands are rich with gems and gold. The king is come unto his hall, under the mountain dark and tall. The worm of dread is slain and dead, and ever so our foe shall fall.
This song appeared to please Thorin, and he smiled again and grew merry. And he began reckoning the distance to the Iron Hills, and how long it would be before Dain could reach the lonely mountain, if he had set out as soon as the message reached him. But Bilbo's heart fell, both at the song and the talk. They sounded much too warlike. The next morning, early, a company of spearmen was seen crossing the river and marching up the valley. They bore with them the green banner of the Elven King and the blue banner of the lake, and they advanced until they stood right before the wall at the gate. Again Thorin hailed them in a loud voice.
"Who are you that come armed for war to the gates of Thorin, son of Thrain, king under the mountain?"
This time he was answered. A tall man stood forward, dark of hair and grim of face, and he cried,
"Hail, Thorin! Why do you fence yourself like a robber in his hold? We are not yet foes, and we rejoice that you are alive beyond our hope. We came expecting to find none living here, yet now that we are met, there is a matter for a parley and a council."
"Who are you, and of what would you parley?"
"I am Bard, and by my hand was the dragon slain and your treasure delivered. Is that not a matter that concerns you? Moreover, I am by right descent the heir of Gideon of Dale, and in your hoard is mingled much of the wealth of his halls and town, which of old Smaug stole. Is not that a matter of which we may speak? Further, in his last battle, Smaug destroyed the dwellings of the men of Esgaroth, and I am yet the servant of their master. I would speak for him, and ask whether you have no thought for the sorrow and misery of his people. They aided you in your distress, and in recompense you have thus far brought ruin only, though doubtless undesigned."
Now these were fair words and true, if proudly and grimly spoken, and Bilbo thought that Thorin would at once admit what justice was in them. He did not, of course, expect that anyone would remember that it was he who discovered all by himself the dragon's weak spot, and that was just as well, for no one ever did. But also he did not reckon with the power that gold has, upon which a dragon has long brooded, nor with dwarvish hearts. Long hours in the past days Thorin had spent in the treasury, and the lust of it was heavy on him. Though he had hunted chiefly for the Arkenstone, yet he had an eye for many another wonderful thing that was lying there, about which were wound old memories of the labours and the sorrows of his race.
"You put your worst cause last, and in the chief place," Thorin answered. "To the treasure of my people no man has a claim, because Smaug, who stole it from us, also robbed him of life or home. The treasure was not his, that his evil deeds should be amended with a share of it. The price of the goods and the assistance that we received of the lake men we will fairly pay in due time. But nothing will we give, not even a loaf's worth, under threat of force. While an armed host lies before our doors, we look on you as foes and thieves. It is in my mind to ask what share of their inheritance you would have paid to our kindred had you found the hoard unguarded and us slain."
"A just question," replied Bard. "But you are not dead, and we are not robbers. Moreover, the wealthy may have pity beyond right on the needy that befriended them when they were in want, and still my other claims remain unanswered."
"I will not parley, as I have said, with armed men at my gate, nor at all with the people of the Elven King, whom I remember with small kindness. In this debate they have no place. Begone now, ere our arrows fly, and if you would speak with me again, first dismiss the elvish host to the woods where it belongs, and then return, laying down your arms before you approach the threshold."
"The Elven King is my friend, and he has succored the people of the lake in their need, though they had no claim but fringe upon him," answered Bard. "We will give you time to repent your words. Gather your wisdom ere we return."
Then he departed and went back to the camp. Ere many hours were passed, the banner bearers returned, and trumpeters stood forth and blew a blast.
"In the name of Esgaroth and the forest," one cried, "we speak unto Thorin Thrain's son Oakenshield, calling himself the king under the mountain, and we bid him consider well the claims that have been urged, or be declared our foe. At the least he shall deliver 1/12 portion of the treasure unto Bard, as the dragon slayer, and as the heir of Gideon. From that portion Bard will himself contribute to the aid of Esgaroth. But if Thorin would have the friendship and honour of the lands about, as his sires had of old, then he will give also somewhat of his own for the comfort of the men of the lake."
Then Thorin seized a bow of horn and shot an arrow at the speaker. It smote into his shield and stuck there quivering.
"Since such is your answer," he called in return, "I declare the mountain besieged. You shall not depart from it until you call on your side for a truce and a parley. We will bear no weapons against you, but we leave you to your gold. You may eat that if you will."
With that the messengers departed swiftly, and the dwarves were left to consider their case. So grim had Thorin become, that even if they had wished, the others would not have dared to find fault with him. But indeed, most of them seemed to share his mind, except perhaps old fat Bomba and Feely and Keely. Bilbo, of course, disapproved of the whole turn of affairs. He had by now had more than enough of the mountain, and being besieged inside it was not at all to his taste. "The whole place still stinks of dragon," he grumbled to himself, "and it makes me sick. And Cram is beginning simply to stick in my throat."
Chapter 16. A Thief in the Night. Now the days passed slowly and wearily. Many of the dwarves spent their time piling and ordering the treasure.
And now Thorin spoke of the Arkenstone of Thrain, and bade them eagerly to look for it in every corner.
"For the Arkenstone of my father," he said, "is worth more than a river of gold in itself, and to me it is beyond price. That stone of all the treasure I name unto myself, and I will be avenged on anyone who finds it and withholds it."
Bilbo heard these words, and he grew afraid, wondering what would happen if the stone was found, wrapped in an old bundle of tattered oddments that he used as a pillow. All the same, he did not speak of it, for as the weariness of the days grew heavier, the beginnings of a plan had come into his little head. Things had gone on like this for some time, when the ravens brought news that Dine and more than 500 dwarves, hurrying from the Iron Hills, were now within about 2 days' march of Dale, coming from the northeast.
"But they cannot reach the mountain unmarked," said Roach. "And I fear lest there be battle in the valley. I do not call this council good. Though they are a grim folk, they are not likely to overcome the host that besets you. And even if they did so, what will you gain? Winter and snow is hastening behind them. How shall you be fed without the friendship and goodwill of the lands about you? The treasure is likely to be your death, though the dragon is no more."
But Thorin was not moved.
"Winter and snow will bite both men and elves," he said, "and they may find their dwelling in the waste grievous to bear. With my friends behind them and winter upon them, they will perhaps be in softer mood to parley with."
That night Bilbo made up his mind. The sky was black and moonless. As soon as it was full dark, he went to a corner of an inner chamber just within the gate and drew from his bundle a rope, and also the Arkenstone wrapped in a rag. Then he climbed to the top of the wall. Only Bomba was there, for it was his turn to watch, and the dwarves kept only one watchman at a time.
"It is mighty cold," said Bomba. "I wish we could have a fire up here as they have in the camp."
"It's warm enough inside," said Bilbo.
"I dare say, but I'm bound here till midnight," grumbled the fat dwarf. "A sorry business altogether. Not that I venture to disagree with Thorin, may his beard grow ever longer, yet he was ever a dwarf with a stiff neck."
"Not as stiff as my legs," said Bilbo. "I'm tired of stairs and stone passages. I would give a good deal for the feel of grass on my toes."
"I would give a good deal for the feel of a strong drink in my throat, and for a soft bed after a good supper."
"I can't give you those while the siege is going on, but it's long since I watched, and I will take your turn for you, if you like. There's no sleep in me tonight."
"You are a good fellow, Mr. Beggins, and I will take your offer kindly. If there should be anything to note, rouse me first, mind you. I will lie in the inner chamber to the left, not far away."
"Off you go," said Bilbo. "I will wake you at midnight, and you can wake the next watchman."
As soon as Bomba had gone, Bilbo put on his ring, fastened his rope, slipped down over the wall, and was gone. He had about 5 hours before him. Bomba would sleep. He could sleep at any time. And ever since the adventure in the forest, he was always trying to recapture the beautiful dreams he had then. And all the others were busy with Thorin. It was unlikely that any, even Feely or Keely, would come out on the wall until it was their turn. It was very dark, and the road after a while, when he left the newly made path and climbed down towards the lower course of the stream, was strange to him. At last he came to the bend where he had to cross the water, if he was to make for the camp as he wished. The bed of the stream was there shallow, but already broad, and finding it in the dark was not easy for the little hobbit. He was nearly across when he missed his footing on a round stone and fell into the cold water with a splash. He had barely scrambled out on the far bank, shivering and spluttering, when up came elves in the gloom with bright lanterns and searched for the cause of the noise.
"That was no fish," said one. "There's a spy about. Hide your lights. They will help him more than us, if it is that queer little creature that is said to be their servant."
"Servant, indeed," snorted Bilbo, and in the middle of his snort he sneezed loudly, and the elves immediately gathered towards the sound.
"Let's have a light," he said. "I'm here if you want me."
And he slipped off his ring and popped from behind a rock. They seized him quickly, in spite of their surprise.
"Who are you? Are you the dwarves' hobbit? What are you doing? How did you get so far past our sentinels?"
they asked one after another.
"I am Mr. Bilbo Baggins," he answered, "companion of Thorin, if you want to know. I know your king well by sight, though perhaps he doesn't know me to look at me. But Bard will remember me, and it is Bard I particularly want to see."
"Indeed," they said. "And what may be your business?"
"Whatever it is, it's my own, my good elves. But if you wish ever to get back to your own woods from this cold, cheerless place," he answered, shivering, "you will take me along quick to a fire, where I can dry, and then you will let me speak to your chiefs as quick as may be. I have only an hour or two to spare."
That is how it came about that some 2 hours after his escape from the gate, Bilbo was sitting beside a warm fire in front of a large tent, and there sat two, gazing curiously at him, both the Elven King and Bard. A hobbit in elvish armour, partly wrapped in an old blanket, was something new to them.
"Really, you know," Bilbo was saying in his best business manner, "things are impossible. Personally, I'm tired of the whole affair. I wish I was back in the West in my own home, where folk are more reasonable. But I have an interest in this matter. 1/14th share, to be precise, according to a letter, which fortunately I believe I've kept." He drew from a pocket in his old jacket, which he still wore over his mail, crumpled and much folded, Thorin's letter that had been put under the clock on his mantelpiece in May.
"A share in the profits, mind you," he went on. "I am aware of that. Personally, I'm only too ready to consider all your claims carefully and deduct what is right from the total before putting in my own claim. However, you don't know Thorin Oakenshield as well as I do now. I assure you, he's quite ready to sit on a heap of gold and starve as long as you sit here."
"Well, let him," said Bard. "Such a fool deserves to starve."
"Quite so," said Bilbo. "I see your point of view. At the same time, winter's coming on fast. Before long, you'll be having snow and whatnot, and supplies will be difficult, even for elves, I imagine. Also, there will be other difficulties. You have not heard of Dine and the dwarves of the Iron Hills?"
"We have, a long time ago. But what has he got to do with us?" asked the king.
"I thought as much. I see I have some information you have not got. Dine, I may tell you, is now less than 2 days' march off, and has at least 500 grim dwarves with him. A good many of them have had experience in the dreadful dwarf and goblin wars, of which you have no doubt heard. When they arrive, there may be serious trouble."
"Why do you tell us this? Are you betraying your friends, or are you threatening us?" asked Bard grimly.
"My dear Bard," squeaked Bilbo, "don't be so hasty. I never met such suspicious folk. I'm merely trying to avoid trouble for all concerned. Now I will make you an offer."
"Let us hear it,"
they said. "You may see it," said he. "It is this." And he drew forth the Arkenstone and threw away the wrapping. The elven king himself, whose eyes were used to things of wonder and beauty, stood up in amazement. Even Bard gazed marvelling at it in silence. It was as if a globe had been filled with moonlight and hung before them in a net woven of the glint of frosty stars. "This is the Arkenstone of Thrain," said Bilbo, "the heart of the mountain, and it's also the heart of Thorin. He values it above a river of gold. I give it to you. It will aid you in your bargaining." Then Bilbo, not without a shudder, not without a glance of longing, handed the marvellous stone to Bard, and he held it in his hand as though dazed.
"But how is it yours to give?" he asked at last, with an effort.
"Oh, well," said the hobbit uncomfortably, "it isn't exactly, but, well, I'm willing to let it stand against all my claim, don't you know? I may be a burglar, or so they say. Personally, I never really felt like one, but I am an honest one, I hope, more or less. Anyway, I'm going back now, and the dwarves can do what they like to me. I hope you will find it useful." The elven king looked at Bilbo with a new wonder.
"Bilbo Baggins," he said, "you are more worthy to wear the armour of elf princes than many that have looked more comely in it. But I wonder if Thorin Oakenshield will see it so. I have more knowledge of dwarves in general than you have, perhaps. I advise you to remain with us, and here you shall be honoured and thrice welcome."
"Thank you very much, I'm sure," said Bilbo with a bow. "But I don't think I ought to leave my friends like this, after all we've gone through together, and I promised to wake old Bomber at midnight, too. Really, I must be going, and quickly." Nothing they could say would stop him, so an escort was provided for him, and as he went, both the king and Bard saluted him with honour. As they passed through the camp, an old man wrapped in a dark cloak rose from a tent door where he was sitting and came towards them.
"Well done, Mr. Baggins," he said, clapping Bilbo on the back. "There is always more about you than anyone expects."
It was Gandalf. For the first time for many a day, Bilbo was really delighted. But there was no time for all the questions that he immediately wished to ask.
"All in good time," said Gandalf. "Things are drawing towards the end now, unless I'm mistaken. There's an unpleasant time just in front of you. But keep your heart up. You may come through all right. There's news brewing that even the ravens have not heard. Good night."
Puzzled but cheered, Bilbo hurried on. He was guided to a safe ford and set across dry, and then he said farewell to the elves and climbed carefully back towards the gate. Great weariness began to come over him, but it was well before midnight when he clambered up the rope again. It was still where he had left it. He untied it and hid it, and then he sat down on the wall and wondered anxiously what would happen next. At midnight he woke up Bomber, and then in turn rolled himself up in his corner without listening to the old dwarf's thanks, which he felt he had hardly earned. He was soon fast asleep, forgetting all his worries till the morning. As a matter of fact, he was dreaming of eggs and bacon. Chapter 17. The clouds burst. Next day, the trumpets rang early in the camp. Soon a single runner was seen hurrying along the narrow path. At a distance he stood and hailed them. asking whether Thorin would now listen to another embassy, since new tidings had come to hand and matters were changed.
"That will be Dain," said Thorin when he heard.